Mind Feed with Nora Casey on News Talk 106 to 108.
You are listening to the sound of a star thumping, heaving, hammering, 1,000,000,000,000,000 tons of stuff spinning 11 times a second. And the woman who discovered that is my next guest. Belfast-born Jocelyn Bell Burnell discovered the first pulsar when she was a PhD student at the University of Cambridge. It was, and still is, the greatest astronomical discovery of the 20th century. However, it was her male supervisor and a colleague, also male, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1974 for her work. Many prominent astronomers expressed outrage, but she's always dealt with it with good grace, and she's never contested the omission. She was the first female president of the Institute of Physics and the Royal Astronomical Society, and this week, the Royal Society of Edinburgh, Scotland's National Academy of Science and the Arts, has appointed her as its first female president. Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell, you're very welcome to the programme. I know you went to the University of Glasgow as well, but was that part of what persuaded you to take up this position?
Yes, I am a graduate from the University of Glasgow. I've also lived and worked in Scotland for about 10 years of my life. And of course, I've been a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh for quite a few years and done a job for them in connection with women in science in Scotland.
So when do you actually take, you're the president-elect at the moment?
That's right. I start in October.
Okay, so if you don't mind, can we go back in time a little bit to early life in Belfast when you were growing up? When people said what you want to be when you grow up, was it always going to be, I want to study physics?
Certainly, as soon as we started studying science at about age 12, it was clear that I was good at physics. And not so long after that, 1957, the Soviets put up the first satellite, Sputnik. And that was a big shock in the West, because both UK and US had assumed they were ahead of the Soviets, and yet we couldn't put up a satellite. So suddenly there was a great emphasis on science, and anyone who could do science was encouraged to do science.
And was it partly to do with your family, Jocelyn, because you always talk about you can convert teachers and pupils, but actually family has an enormous influence on the choice of studying science?
Yes, family does have an enormous choice, and my parents were always very encouraging that the girls got as much good education as their brother. So, yeah.
And your dad was an architect, so is there any other scientists in your family?
My brother is an engineer in Belfast. My younger sister is a web designer in Oxford.
So when you were going to Lurgan College, for instance, early studies, it wasn't typical at that time for girls to study science, was it?
No, the norm was that the girls did domestic science, and in the first year of secondary school, they divided us accordingly, sent the boys to the science lab and the girls to the domestic science room.
What did you do about that?
Well, I tried protesting, saying, because my parents had promised me I'd get to do science when we started secondary school. So I tried protesting, but the teacher wasn't hearing it. So I enlisted my parents' help, told them that evening what had happened, and they hit the roof.
Did they go down and see that teacher?
Well, I think they talked to the head, actually.
And you were quickly moved from cross-stitching.
Yes, as were a couple of other girls as well. The local GP had a daughter in my class, and there was another girl as well that I remember. So the next time the science class met, there were all the boys and a wee handful of girls.
Jocelyn, I'm hesitant to even ask you this, because my boy is studying his mock for the junior cert at the moment. Mm-hmm. But did I read somewhere you failed your 11 plus?
Yes, I did indeed. Qualifying, as we called it in Northern Ireland, yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't quite know, because I was coming top in the science exam next term at school, you know, just 6 months after, beating all the kids who'd passed the 11 plus. So whether I was just a late developer, whether the teaching was bad, whether it was because there was no science in the qualifying, I don't quite know, to be honest.
Do you think, look, I listen to him, as most 15-year-olds, you know, all they talk about is what school is a waste of time, they teach you nothing that you're going to learn in later life. Do teachers have a big influence in terms of, well, in your own case, for instance, in the choice of following physics?
I went away to boarding school in England at age 13 and had a very good physics teacher there. I was probably going to do physics anyway, but he certainly confirmed it. He was quite an old man, coming out of retirement for a second time to teach us, but he was just so good at explaining it. And when he realized that I was competent at physics, he let me do extra work on my own at the back of the class. So I got to sit some scholarship exams, which I don't think anybody else did in physics.
You, as you said a little while ago there, you went to the University of Glasgow. I actually studied nursing in Glasgow, so I know what Glasgow's like. Mm. I wouldn't imagine there were many girls reading physics at the University of Glasgow.
There were normally a handful, but in my particular year there wasn't. And I was the only girl doing honours physics, along with 49 men.
Wow. Were they very welcoming of you joining their class?
Well, it was what was traditional in Glasgow then. Whenever a woman walked into the lecture hall, everybody whistled and catcalled and stamped and banged the desks.
Wow. That must have been a bit uncomfortable, though.
Yes. I discovered that if you blush, they make more noise, and that you can actually control your blushing. So that's what I did.
Bit of a school of hard knocks, maybe, leaving home and, you know, university life and having to face that kind of... Did it feel like it was ostracization, or is that too big a word for it?
Well, I'd had already left home because I'd been at boarding school for a fair number of years. So that wasn't an issue. It was what they always did when there were women around, particularly if there weren't too many women. It was kind of tradition in Glasgow. I didn't like it, but at one level I didn't blame my colleagues for doing it because they were only doing what previous generations of students had taught them to do. Mm. But I'm still a bit cross with the academic staff who took no measures to stop it.
Mm. Have things changed now?
I believe so, yes.
But you weren't finished with your studies yet. You graduated from the University of Glasgow. And what happened next?
I was very keen to do radio astronomy, and the way into it was to do a PhD. So I planned to do a PhD straight after my physics degree at Glasgow. The only question was where I did this PhD.
And did you always plan to do it in the area of, you said radio physics, in the area of pulsars, of stars?
Well, of radio astronomy was the area I was interested in, picking up radio waves from stars and galaxies, yes.
And describe, so people afterwards now describe it as, you know, the single greatest astronomical discovery of the 20th century, but what I guess listener would be interested to hear is, how did it come about? How did you discover that you had made this amazing discovery?
Well, it was an accident, but in one sense it was an accident waiting to happen. I ended up in Cambridge for my PhD, which wasn't something I had expected to do, and was really rather overawed, feeling quite provincial, surrounded by all these people who seemed so terribly bright. And I wasn't quite sure I was going to make the grade, but I was quite determined that if they were going to throw me out, I would have done my very best before that. So I was working very hard, being very thorough, being very careful. And it's because I was being very thorough, very careful, that I noticed this funny, spurious signal, which I didn't have to take note of. I could have, you know, ignored it. But I was wanting to just make sure I understood everything that that telescope was picking up. And so it led to the discovery of these amazing new objects called pulsars or neutron stars.
And just describe, was there a moment when you realized that this was something different? Or was it a dawning realization over a period of time?
I realized the signal was a bit funny instantly, but whether it was funny because there was something wrong, whether there was a fault, which was the most likely, or whether it was funny because it was something cosmic, initially you don't know. Finding a second one laid a lot of those worries to rest. And I found a third and a fourth as well. So that really does begin to look like something new out there in space.
And Justin, just as a, you know, you're a young academic and you're discovering this yourself, I assume. Mm. Were you tempted to kind of question yourself and redo your work over and again, or did you run straight into your supervisor and say, you'll never guess what I've just discovered?
Mm. Oh, I was in fairly continual touch with my supervisor. We had already decided that whatever this funny signal was, I should look at it more carefully. So I was in the process of doing that.
And was he was Anthony Hewish?
That's right.
And
yes.
was he alongside you all of the time during this, or were there lonely nights and days on your own when you were studying?
No, I was very much left to get on with it, reporting back to him when there was something to report back on.
And when you got to the point where you felt you'd sufficient evidence, sufficient weight of evidence, you then decided that you would publish, you'd go public.
That's the normal practice, yes, indeed. That would be absolutely what any scientist would be doing. Yeah.
And then did you write the paper together, or how did that come about?
I don't remember the details, but it will have been circulated, drafts will have been circulated amongst all the potential authors.
And
we will have, you know, worked on it in that sense together.
Together. And how many people were involved in that? Your name was second on
yes.
the list of authors, so it always goes
yep.
in terms of priority. And how many others were listed as authors of the paper?
There were five of us all together.
And extraordinarily... Just to put this into context, and it is, I think it's a little odd for people listening nowadays to imagine, but at the time when you discovered pulsars, people thought that it could have been a form of communication from intelligent extraterrestrial civilization.
It was one of the many options that crossed our minds, but as soon as I find the second one, that option goes away. And it's thoroughly dead by the time I find the third and the fourth, because there wouldn't be so many lots of little green men out there signalling to Earth.
So here we are, you've published in Nature, you're in second place as the author.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1974, the Nobel Prize was given for
mm-hmm.
that particular discovery, but it wasn't given to you.
That's right.
It was given to your supervisor, to Anthony Hewish, and another male colleague.
The other male colleague was the head of group, and he got the Nobel Prize for some work he'd done in radio astronomy. He wasn't involved particularly with the pulsar stuff.
You've always been. I've you know read a lot about you, Jocelyn. I've watched you speak. You've always been very circumspect about the fact that they omitted to include you. Very magnanimous about it. Do you still feel that way when you look back?
Oh yes, yes. It was. An important precedent because it was the first time that there was a prize going to astronomers, and I was really rather proud that it was our stars that had convinced them that there was good physics in astronomy. And I've also discovered that actually you can do very, very well out of not getting a Nobel Prize. You see, you get a lot of sympathy, and at around about that time as well, feminism was coming up. So I always reckon I've been carried on a wave of feminism and a wave of sympathy, and I've been awarded just about every other prize that moves.
I know. In fairness, it hasn't held you back. But at the time, were colleagues, you know, were they incensed by the fact that you were... I know you're not, and I know that when you talk about it, you always talk about it in very measured tones. But, you know, your colleagues in your particular sphere, were they not incensed that you were excluded?
I think my generation, you know, other graduate students... thought it was an injustice, yes.
And were they vocal to you? Were they vocal, you know, publicly about it?
I don't know they were vocal anywhere, to be honest.
Right, this is kind of said it very quietly, but you've always said you're in good company.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, there's a lot of people that haven't got a Nobel Prize.
Exactly.
An awful lot.
But It has never held you back. I mean, you just mentioned you've 10 or more very significant honours, including a CBE, a DBE in 1999, over 20 honorary doctorates.
Mm.
But since that discovery, I was trying to imagine myself, you know, if you were to discover something which people claim is, you know, the greatest astronomical discovery of the 20th century, is it all a bit anticlimactic thereafter? You know, is everything else that you do just coming down from that great high?
Well, there's certainly... is an issue is too strong a word, but can't think of a better one at the moment. The problem is sort of living up to that, and that's actually impossible, as I fairly quickly realised. You don't have the luck to make that kind of discovery. Many people don't get to make it at all. I mean, when you do make it, you're not going to have that luck again either.
No.
So, you know, that's just part of life.
Was there anything that got away? Is there, you know, I mean, it seems ridiculous me even asking you that when you've done so much. I mean, anybody else doing 10% of what you've done would be saying, I've had a great life. But was there any moment during that time where you think, God, I wish I'd discovered that? Somebody else did something that you would have wanted to have chased after?
No, I don't think so. I very much enjoy astronomy because there are discoveries happening right, left and centre. It's an enormously exciting subject, and it's been a great privilege to be a part of it over the last 50 years or whatever. And the astronomical community has been very generous to me as well. So I have had one whale of a time.
You have been an incredible influence, I think, on young women in particular, because you've always been a passionate ambassador, especially about girls and science. And, you know, it's a big problem here in Ireland as well. What's the solution? You know, you have all this weight of knowledge. What's the solution to try and encourage more young women in particular to go into science?
Well, I'm afraid there isn't a single solution. There's no magic bullet, or we would have found it long ago. What we've basically got to do is change how society thinks about what's suitable for young women. This varies enormously from country to country, so we can see that the problem is to do with the culture in a particular country, and it's nothing to do with women's brains or abilities. So we've got to somehow convince people that science, and engineering for that matter, are perfectly acceptable occupations for women, quite appropriate, no problems there at all. And just get more people in, more role models, more mentors, and just keep plowing away at it.
And Justin, just, you know, I'd love to ask you just a little bit about what you've learned from some of these experiences you've had. If you were, you know, I suppose if you were writing a letter to your younger self, you know, there you were back in Cambridge, what would you say to yourself?
I'd say that it was good that I knew from quite an early age, like mid-teens, what I wanted to do. Knowing where you want to go is enormously helpful when you meet obstacles. And obstacles aren't entirely bad things either, because they help you sort your priorities. Do I really want to do this? Yes, I do. Therefore, I'm going to stick out whatever the current phase or issue is, so that I get to do what I want to do.
Yeah, you're a great example for people listening. You know, you're a great example of somebody who's never actually stopped wanting to put yourself forward. You've always fulfilled your potential, Jocelyn, because even now you're about to take on a big challenge. You're going to be the president of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. Is there any point when you put your feet up and say, I'm just going to have a little rest now?
Well, I do keep trying to, you know, slow life down.
How's that working for you?
I guess I get lots of wonderful invitations to do things. I think, oh, I'll just do this and I'll just do that. But I am getting to an age where I have to pace myself a bit.
What's left to do, Jocelyn? Is there anything on the list that you say, okay, I want to do this. This is my ambition.
I'm not sure there is. There are places I want to visit, holidays I want to take. But in terms of, you know, my professional career, I have had a ball. I really have.
If I gave you a ticket on board, a rocket going up into space, would you take it?
No, I wouldn't be interested in that. It's too much fun down here.
We have this panel, actually, that appears in the programme, Jocelyn. And every week, there's a politician, a taxi driver, a 12-year-old, a graduate. We ask them a question. So this week, the question we've asked them is, if you could fly anywhere on the planet, right now, magic wand, where would it be? So where would you like to go if I could transport you?
Well, given it's winter here, it might be Southern Hemisphere. I'm very fond of New Zealand. I would like to see the southern tip of Chile, where I think the scenery is spectacular, and I've never got there. So probably those would be the places that would be top of my list.
I think I'm with you there. Dame Jocelyn Bell-Burnell, it was a pleasure to talk to you on the programme today.